Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is David Guterson, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Other, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Andre Debuse III and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. David Guterson is with us tonight to present his new novel, The Other. His books keep getting better. He just drops in these pitch-perfect notes and keeps the music going, said a recent review in the New York Times. We are so glad that David is back for this new title. David is a Penn Faulkner Award winner who burst on the publishing scene with his debut novel, Snow Falling on Cedars. His books also include East of the Mountains and Our Lady of the Forest. He co-founded Field's End, a writer's community in Bainbridge Island, whose mission is to inspire writers and nurture the written word through lectures and workshops. You can get more information on fieldsend.org, but please give a warm welcome to David Guterson.
Thank you very much. The first time I've been to this new store, and it's a great space, and I think everybody in Denver who loves books knows how lucky they are to have Tattered Cover, one of the best bookstores in the country, and I'm grateful that you brought me here tonight. I'm also grateful to all of you for coming out. I know there are a lot of things you can do, and anytime anybody cares enough about books, and in my case in particular, my books, to come out and hear what I have to say is I'm gratified by it. And I mean, obviously, writers spend most of their time sitting in a room by themselves, and every once in a while you publish a book and you go out into the world, and some people like it, some people don't, but I like it because otherwise it's I forget that there's, you know, that the word audience is not something abstract. It's real people. I can actually look into people's eyes and be reminded that the book makes a connection with real human beings. There's somebody at the other end. And I always remind myself that I'm not writing just to put it in a drawer and I'm not writing for me. By definition, the act of writing is an act of communication. And it can be abstract until you show up and meet people. So for all those reasons, I'm genuinely happy to be here. I think people are often interested in knowing, you know, where a book comes from and why you decided to write what you decided to write. And particularly this book, which is about a hermit, in large degree about a hermit, about other things too, I think it's natural to wonder, you know, what might bring a writer to something like that. And in my case, my interest goes back into childhood. I think we're all aware of the fact, I just went into the children's section back here real briefly, in fact, and looked around just to reassure myself that this is still true, and it is still true, that kids have an interest in stories about kids who go into the woods and get lost in the woods, and the woods are often dark and deep and disturbing. And in those woods, they often meet figures who are also potentially disturbing, the very least strange, perhaps deranged, perhaps dangerous, perhaps wise, or some combination thereof. But hermits make their appearance in children's literature. And when I think back to my own childhood, I know that stories of that nature really stayed with me, really interested me. And the same thing was true in, I guess they call it, the preteen or pre-adolescent years, when you start reading things like Robinson Crusoe and Swiss Family Robinson, books that, again, are about people who are living a solitary life, perhaps not by their own choice, but nevertheless by circumstances, you know, thrown upon it, where they have to survive and figure out how to deal with solitude. Yes? Yoda in Star Wars, I'm sorry? Was a hermit, yes. Well, the hermit tradition, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because a whole other area that I eventually got interested in of writing about, and even ultimately sometimes by, hermits are those who renounce the world and become reclusive in the name of some kind of spiritual investigation or exploration or pursuit. And yeah, Yoda would probably fit into that. And there's John the Baptist and this whole tradition of the Christian desert fathers, a Christian hermetic tradition that we see running through monastic life. And we see it in Buddhism as well, and we see it in Hinduism. Really throughout the spiritual life of human beings, you see this impulse towards the woods and towards hermitry as a way of coming to grips with one's spiritual life. And so that's another tradition of writing about hermits that I got interested in at a later stage. I do remember in high school and in college being drawn to Thoreau, even though I don't think Thoreau really quite qualifies as a hermit. There was a guy who went to Walden for a while to see what would happen. But he was actually, as you know, a very socially engaged person who cared much about society, what was happening in the world. On the other hand, somebody like Emily Dickinson, who I was also drawn to, and particularly in college, was a bona fide recluse who, she was agoraphobic. She had a fear of public places. She stayed in her house. She never published her poems. When she passed away, they found literally thousands of poems stuffed into her desk drawer that were all published posthumously. And again, I felt myself drawn to just these sorts of writers, and also to the romantic poets whose view of nature was that you might go to nature for redemption or salvation, that this world, the industrialized world, the social world with all its complications, was somehow lesser in spirit than the world of nature. And so people like Wordsworth in particular, or Shelley or Keats, those were writers who had a romantic view of nature, and I felt myself drawn in that direction as well. So I guess my point is, I got interested in writing about hermits because I recognized in my own reading over various stages of my life that I'd been drawn to stories about hermits, to ideas about wilderness that had to do with redemption and spirituality. And, you know, as a writer, it's good for me to recognize what it is I'm interested in reading and thinking, looking back on my own obsessions, and realize I have to be feeling obsessive about something to write a novel about it, because it's going to be with me for however many years it takes to write it. And unless you really have a passion for what you're writing about, you'll just flag. You won't finish. There's something like running a marathon in writing a novel. It probably takes all kinds of, you know, you could talk about different traits that it takes to be a novelist, this, that, and the other. But I know one thing that it takes is just the ability to persist. You know, a lot of people want to write novels and they have all kinds of ability and they're talented and they know how to use the language and so on, but they just never actually write the novel because it takes this persistence. And having that persistence and just seeing it through is a lot easier when you feel a real passion about, you know, the subject that you're engaging. So I'm real careful about thinking that through before I start to write and being sure that it's something that I actually really care about. This interest in hermitry wasn't really, for me as a realist, an easy thing to engage, because in the strict realist sense, it's impossible for somebody to live on their own in the woods. And it's something I looked into as objectively as I could. And even among indigenous people, they were dependent on one another for their survival. One of the worst things that could happen to you in a small tribe was to be banished, because it meant you were going to die. You were going to be on your own. There's a well-known nonfiction book by an anthropologist, Theodora Kroeber, called Ishi, the Last of His Tribe. And Ishi was a Modoc in Northern California. Everybody else died. He was the last member of his tribe. He was born into, you know, circumstances where he learned all of the skills he would need to survive, and yet on his own he couldn't do it, and eventually he started stealing corn, and you know, they didn't know who he was or what he was. They jailed him, and then these anthropologists, Arthur and Theodora Kroeber, came across him and figured out who he was. As a side note, the Krobers were the parents of Ursula Le Guin, the writer Ursula Le Guin. And I once met her and asked her about Ishi, and she said that this had all happened before she was even born, so no information there, no inside information on Ishi. But you're probably also aware of John Krakauer's book or the movie Into the Wild, a very sad story about this kid with a very romantic impulse and an enormous wanderlust and a kind of political and social critique that said, I want to liberate myself from convention. He lasted about 100 days in a bus in Alaska. In that book, Krakauer also makes reference to some other people who tried the same thing. None of them were really able to do it. And then I did one more little piece of research. I had actually read in the local paper where I live up near Seattle, and there was an article about a guy who they said had lived in the woods for 7 years. And I ended up tracking down these law enforcement guys, three of them, who had ultimately arrested him because every few months he would get desperate and he would break into a cabin and steal canned goods and take a shower and take the towels and sleep on the bed and leave mud. And after a couple of years of this string of cabin break-ins in the same area, they figured out that whoever was doing it was living in the woods. But this guy came about as close as anybody I've heard of. I mean, he could go for months at a time living in what conditions that these law enforcement guys described as sort of Neanderthal. I mean, he just absolutely primitive, but persistent. They also described him as possibly deranged to some extent. So, you know, as a fiction writer, I had this challenge. I wanted to write about a hermit in a realist mode, but it isn't really realistic. There was another challenge, which is that a story about a hermit can sound inherently boring because it's about somebody who just goes to the woods and does nothing, essentially doesn't interact with other people. There's really no, all right, so you went to the woods, now what? You know, so I had that problem too. I had a dramatic challenge in this book. So a couple of things. Number one, I decided that my interest was really in not so much what happens when this person goes to the woods, but in what prompts him to do it, in what drives him to it. The story is really about what brings him to it more than anything else. And then the other element, the dramatic element, bringing other people into it, I resolved by tying it to the survival, to the impossibility of surviving in the wild question. If you can't survive in the wild on your own, then you're going to need help, which implies a second character. In my novel, that second character is the narrator of the novel, the person who is showing up in the woods as often as he can to bring food and other necessities and to try to talk his friend out of what he's doing. So they're engaged in this ongoing dialogue about whether or not this guy is doing the right thing. One of the other things that I got interested in then as I developed this and developed this other character was thinking back, these guys meet when they're 16. It's 1972. They're high school kids. And I wanted to put myself back there and think through to what that was like. And as I did that, I realized that I've made other friends since then in my 20s, 30s, 40s, you know. I've met new people. I like them. And we've developed a certain degree of intimacy. And I would even call it affection. I would even call it love that I feel for friends that I've made in the last 30 plus years. But it's distinctly different from my adolescent relationships. And my adolescent relationships are also different from my childhood relationships. For some reason, between the ages of about 14 or 15 and 19 or 20, there's a little interlude there where your friendships are very much freighted with meaning for you and imbued with a kind of tension, even, if you will, that you don't get at any other time in life. And I really wanted to put myself back there because I remember my own friendships that felt like that, that were so meaningful to me, about which I felt so conflicted. I would feel a fierce loyalty to a friend, but inwardly, privately, I could really feel some loathing for the same person. This sort of conflicted feeling about my friends, very intense. And so in this story, I wanted to take myself back and look at adolescent friendship and also this hermit question, and sort of those are really the two main driving forces in this novel. So it opens in 1972, and the narrator's name is Neil Countryman, and he is from blue-collar Irish stock. The men in his family are all working in the trades, electrician, plumber, you know, general contractors. And he's running in a half-mile race, a track race, against a kid from named John William Barry, who goes to Lakeside, which is Seattle's foremost prep school. It's where Bill Gates, for example, went. And these two guys run this race and find a kind of affinity for each other. And one thing, as it turns out, that they both have an affinity for is travel in the woods. They both like to hike and climb. And they start doing a lot of this together in the spirit of what I would call sort of untrained, reckless adventurism. It's not as if they really know what they're doing, but they have that kind of youthful bravado that takes them into not only situations that are precarious, but also situations that are intentionally precarious, where they say to themselves, well, let's go for an extended period off trail and not take a compass or not take matches or not take enough food and see what happens, you know, that kind of a relationship. And they obviously, you know, you can really bond over that kind of thing. And on one of these adventures, they find, they smell sulfur and they find a seep in the ground. They dig it up and they've discovered hot springs in the Olympic Mountains, which are west of Seattle. And this prompts in this wealthy kid the idea that this, if you ever wanted to live on your own in the woods, that this is where you might want to do it because you've got access to a heat source in the winter, which is probably the key survival issue. So he chooses this place, and he makes his friend promise not to ever tell anybody about it. And at first, his friend feels, the narrator, Neil, his friend feels like, well, this is just a lark, you know, something that someone tries out, and after a year or so, he'll give up, and or maybe less, and move on to something else. But as the years go by, he realizes that, no, this is the life he's chosen. And he seems to be maybe disturbed, and he can't really talk him out of it. And it's not, I don't think I'm revealing something that would ruin the story for you since I reveal this on within the first five pages, but at the age of 50, in other words, many, many years after this, Neil finds out that he is the heir to John Williams' fortune, which is $440 million. So he's suddenly been told by this lawyer, well, the remains of your friend have been found in the woods, and that now we have a death certificate, and so now we can execute the will. And the will says, you have $440 million. And at this point, you know, Neil hasn't thought about his friend for 30 years. So now he's wondering, why did this happen, and how did this happen, and who was this guy, and why did he leave me this money? And so the novel is really the story of him looking back to try to figure out his friend and see if he can't come to grips with what has happened and why his friend has left him this money. And so that's the basic, you know, sense of plot and character in this book. It's about two guys who take really divergent paths. Again, you know, this rich kid, because he can, he goes and lives in the woods by himself. And this blue-collar kid fairly rapidly chooses a very conventional life, you know, graduates from high school, goes on to college, becomes a high school English teacher, gets married, has kids, buys a house, settles down pretty much in the same neighborhood that he grew up in, and just lives this quiet life. A couple of reviews that I've read of the book have mentioned that this sounds suspiciously like the biographical facts of the author's life. And in fact, this book is more autobiographical than any of the others. I mean, like Neil Countryman, I graduated from Roosevelt High School Public School in Seattle in 1974. And like Neil, I went on to the University of Washington, which was not far away, got a teaching certificate. I've lived close to where I grew up my whole life. You know, got married young, had kids. Everything about Neil, those basic facts fit me. But the other thing is that inwardly, in some private space, so do the facts of John Williams' life. Not so much the money, but this draw towards hermitry. I know that I have this ongoing dialogue with myself, this private talk I have with myself in which I hear two voices. And one of them is this guy who says, look, I can't save the world. I can't really change the world. I just have to do the best that I can do. I'll go to my job every day at the high school and I'll talk about poetry and stories with kids and maybe it will be good for them. What else can I do? That's really the only skill and ability that I have, and I'll do that. And, I'll try to keep my own personal carbon footprint kind of small and ride my bike a little bit and, this, that, and the other and do the best I can do. But I'm not going to go live in the woods because I feel that any connection to society somehow compromises me. You know, I'm not so pure in my values that I'm willing to forsake everything about a normal life in the name of upholding my values. But then there's this other side of me that I find exacerbated by experiences like the ones I've been having recently because I'm on a book tour. And so the decisions about how I live and what I do aren't really mine. My publisher, they arrange all the details of a book tour. I mean, you get on an airplane and you show up in a town and you stay in a hotel and so on. And I have this dialogue with myself the whole time. I say to myself, I put the key in the hotel room door and I walk in and the air conditioning's on. And I say, the last person checked out, they've had the air conditioning on the whole, that's wrong, I say to myself. And I, what's the first thing you do? You go to the bathroom. There's 12 towels in there. I mean, or more, all for me. This isn't right. All these towels, just for me. I go look on the bed. There's 12 pillows, just for me. It isn't right. None of this is right. None of this. I have this cubicle here of space with not only all my needs being met, but all possible luxuries, all aimed just at me, while literally billions of people in the world suffer and starve and have nothing. You see, I'm telling you, this goes through my head. And it goes through a lot of your heads, too. It's this dialogue you have with yourself. And at the same time that you're thinking all this stuff, you're going, I'm hungry. I wonder what's on the room service menu. You just go on in this way. You just go forward with this, carrying this inner contradiction with you wherever you go. So when I call this book The Other, I'm not so much talking about somebody else. I'm talking about me. The other is something inside of you. I mean, it really is. I know there's more than one me. Frankly, I believe there's more than two. But there's at least two. There's a normal guy living a normal life, essentially. I mean, you may think that, all right, so I've published books on that. It means my life is very normal. I wake up every morning and I go do my job and I, do the laundry and pull the weeds and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just a normal life. I feel like my life is just a normal life. And at the same time inside, I'm thinking, this isn't right. The world isn't set up the right way, and I'm the beneficiary of the whole thing, and I don't feel good about it, but I just keep going, So I have these two voices. There's an other that lives in me. And in this book, what I wanted to do was work with it. I wanted to look at it. I wanted to get deeply into this inner conflict that I have, or this inner dialogue that I have, and explore it in the context of narrative, which is my way of looking at the questions that I have about life. I mean, I find story a more compelling way to address the questions that I have than any other way. And I think a lot of people end up reading stories because they feel the same way. Yes, you're looking for entertainment. I mean, yes, you want to buy a book and you want to turn the page to find out what happens next. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I want that too. But you also want an opportunity to look at those same basic questions in life that authors look at, that I look at, and the narrative hopefully creates that opportunity. It gives you a context in which to consider, maybe more deeply than you otherwise would, certain fundamental questions that derive from the fact that you're human. And I'm, as I said at the start, you know, I know that being a writer is about making connection with others. And the way for me to make that happen is to write about the things that I care the most deeply about, with the faith that because we're all human, you're going to care about them too. And if I'm genuinely and sincerely exploring questions that matter to me, then that's going to create an opportunity for you to also genuinely and sincerely explore those same questions. And for me, that's what it's about. And I know that there's no way to share that, to make that connection, for us to do that jointly, unless the book is entertaining, because otherwise you won't want to turn the page. Right? That's the first duty that I feel that I have to readers. And my view of it is that it should feel like a dream. I feel like a good dream, a dream that you don't want to wake up from. It's a whole lived-in world that you fall into. When you get to the last page, you, in a way, you feel wistful, like you don't want it to end because this world is so complete that you want to stay there and you care about the people and you're loving being in the dream and you don't want to wake up. But also at the end, you feel like, well, this is right. It's all come together and you have a feeling of satisfaction intellectually and emotionally about what you've just, you know, what you've just been through. And hopefully it stays with you afterwards for a while. You know, that's what my hope is for my books. And when I read reviews and a reviewer says, this book stayed with me, and then I feel like I've succeeded, you know, that it got inside somebody and it stuck with them for a while afterwards. And I hope that, you know, that's what's happening in this novel. Yes?
Have you spent much time in the woods yourself?
Well, have I spent much time in the woods alone? I've spent a lot of time in the woods, and if you read this book and you see, you catch the texture of these adolescent trips into the woods, it's very much the sort of thing, the way that my friends and I, this book is dedicated to my three closest friends from adolescence, and it very much takes up the fabric, the texture, the tenor, the kinds of trips we liked to take when we were young. And I have continued since then. But the trips feel a little different now. And maybe I'll just read a little bit about that, just like a paragraph, so you get a sense of where I'm at now with this business. Earlier this summer, for the first time in 11 years, I hiked in the valley of the South Fork Ho, where John William and I went without a compass or matches 2 days after our acid trip. So yeah, you know, our adolescent forays in the wilderness were drug-fueled. And when John William spent 7 years living alone, the trail passes under Sitka spruces, some more than 500 years old, and under big-leaf maples hung with club moss, you would have to say that, given the presence of these maples, this isn't quite your classic rainforest, but a variation, with the maples thriving amid cobbles and rock slides and in the glacial till of the river bottom. Rain on the South Fork Ho is common, but on my recent walk, there was no sign of rain. Instead, it was warm and a little dusty where the silt had baked in the sun on the north bank. Still, rain remains this region's most obvious feature in any season but summer. Notable, too, is the silence here, broken infrequently by the winter wren's trill, reminiscent of a hysterically played flute, at other times by the ventriloquy of ravens. Then there's the din of the river, fed by snow in the Valhallas and glaciers on Mount Olympus. In June, the South Fork Ho runs gray and milky. It's in places slow enough to suggest tranquility, but elsewhere it's extreme in its energy and character. So this is a hike of disparate feeling, unfolding under a dense forest canopy broken by glades of Arcadian maples. It's also a hike through lonely country, 4.5 hours by car from Seattle, infrequently visited not only for this reason, but because the main fork, a few miles to the north, has a better road and a visitor center near its bank. More, the Main Fork Trail leads climbers to Mount Olympus, whereas the South Fork Trail just leads to deeper gloom and eventually into a canyon. Sometimes anglers will try the South Fork's upper stretches. Even more rarely, a party of climbers will pass through on its way to the Valhallas, though I should point out that the first ascents of those peaks were mostly made in 1978 and none earlier than 1966, which should give you some idea of their remoteness. When John William and I first went there in 74, wandering into Valkyrie Creek Basin and making camp on Valhalla Ridge, the pinnacles of Braggy, Memer, Vili, Sleipner, and Veeder North and South had not yet been climbed. And this wasn't because of their difficulties, but because few climbers had gotten to them. They might have been busy with more accessible mountains, or maybe they hadn't noticed this part of the map yet, southeast of the town of Forks. This June, I walked alone on the South Fork Ho Trail, 3 days after the end of the school year, 1 day after the graduation ceremony held because of foreboding skies in our remodeled gym, where students hooted as I strode to the podium in order to recite into all that space underneath a raised basketball hoop, "The Road Not Taken." I have an annual date with Frost at this ceremony. In the past, I've read the poem's well-known final lines with embarrassed misgivings. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Will the narrator's apparent self-regard accrue to me? Will the convocation, seeing Frost's narrator as superior, see me as superior by association? This year, after I cleared my throat, a student yelled, "Seas all filthy," meaning Mr. Countryman's rich. And after everyone twittered, I delivered the Frost. The following day, the first of vacation, I got up early, filled my thermos with coffee, made a sandwich, and drove away before first light. And frankly, despite the things I like about my work, felt glad I was free to walk along the South Fork Ho instead of teach. It's an easy journey in its lower reaches. In 3 miles, a hiker gains 500 feet, and after that, where the trail fades to moss, it's a matter of meandering across soft green flats or treading on gravel bars near the current. I found myself preferring moss to gravel, even though there's less gloom beside the water, because recently I've developed a Morton's neuroma, where the third and fourth toes on my right foot meet, and this makes me wince if I walk too many hours on unforgiving surfaces like river stones. Pain gives me reason to stop more often than I once did. I take off my boots. I eat a little something or shut my eyes for a few minutes. Sometimes I lie in the fetal position and try unsuccessfully to sleep in the forest. It was in this posture in June that I heard a trilling winter wren and later a raven. The raven's call was like water dripping loudly, like large drops of water striking a pool. It seemed to have nothing to do with nature. Instead, it sounded like a plumbing problem. I wouldn't have thought it was made by a bird at all, except that on other occasions I'd watched ravens make this noise, though even with such clear verification, it's a note that still seems improbable and dreamlike, as does the past sometimes. So, yeah, I think hopefully you can see, you know, as I've gotten older, I go by myself, get up early, I like it, but then my foot starts to hurt. So I have to sit more, and I listen more, and I absorb more. I'm more into being there. When I was younger, it was, let's get stoned and go and try to get in trouble, you know? And so it's very different now to be traveling in the woods, and I still love to go. I mean, well, okay, so I'll be up here to sign books if you want, and if you have any other questions that you want to talk about, feel free. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Andre DeBoost III and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on June 23rd, 2008.